From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, veteran broadcaster David Brinkley. After 40 years of covering elections, he signed off on his final election night broadcast on Tuesday with some shocking remarks. This Sunday, he steps down as host of This Week with David Brinkley. We'll listen back to a 1989 interview with him. And Irish writer William Trevor. He's been described as the greatest living writer of short stories in the English language. His new book is After Rain. Book critic Maureen Corrigan considers The Rules, a new book about how to capture Mr. Right, and wonders what would have happened had some of literature's famous heroines followed the book's advice. That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has chosen North Carolina businessman Erskine Bowles for the job of chief of staff. Bowles will succeed Leon Panetta, who's returning to his home state of California, possibly to run for governor. The changes in the White House mirror the changes in the Clinton cabinet. NPR's Peter Kenyon says several cabinet secretaries are leaving.
So far, we know about Secretary of State Warren Christopher, whose resignation has been accepted. Labor Secretary Robert Reich has just confirmed that he'll also be leaving. Defense Secretary William Perry is going. Other names on the May leave list include HUD Secretary Cisneros, Transportation Secretary Federico Pena, and there may be a couple of others as well.
One other name may include Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary, but no word on her possible resignation has been announced. Veteran news correspondent Pierre Salinger says a U.S. Navy missile accidentally shot down TWA Flight 800 near New York last July, killing all 230 people aboard. David Culhane reports from Paris.
Salinger says he has a document to support the charge, and he's sticking to that story in spite of denials from the FBI, the Pentagon, and the Navy. The National Transportation Safety Board has in the past rejected scenarios that involved a possible friendly fire situation. Salinger says his document proves the airliner, flying too low and behind schedule, entered an area where the U.S. Navy was staging missile tests. The one-time White House spokesman for President Kennedy originally set forth his allegations of an accident followed by a cover-up at a speech before airline executives from 20 countries meeting in the southern French city of Cannes. He's now offering to show his document to the FBI. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
Indian Air Force planes and helicopters are staging an emergency airlift of food and medicine to 500,000 stranded people. The southeast Indian coast is reeling from a cyclone Wednesday night that killed at least 1,000 people. The death toll is expected to rise. The storm pounded the Andhra Pradesh state the worst. Winds were clocked at up to 100 miles per hour. Crops are destroyed, roads are gone. Many fatalities occurred when mud walls of homes collapsed upon occupants. The Army continues to investigate a sex scandal at a training facility in Maryland. At least a dozen women have been identified as alleged victims of rape or molestation at the installation. The women were trainees at the Army Ordnance Center at Maryland's Aberdeen Proving Ground. Three instructors face courts-martial. Two of them, a captain and a sergeant, are charged with several crimes, including rape. A third sergeant is charged with obstructing justice. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 13.5 points at 61.92. Trading is moderate. This is NPR. Norfolk Southern has sweetened its offer for Conrail Railroad by 10%. The offer now stands at $10 billion in cash. 2 days ago, CSX Corporation increased its own bid for the Philadelphia-based freight railroad to $8.5 billion in cash and stock. Control over freight lines in the heavily populated eastern part of the United States is at stake. Whoever gets to buy Conrail would become the third largest freight carrier in the United States. A former Chicago congressman already in prison on a sexual misconduct conviction faces new charges of bank fraud and campaign finance fraud. David Shaper of member station WBEZ in Chicago reports.
A 16-count federal grand jury indictment charges former Democratic Congressman Mel Reynolds and his wife Marisol with lying to banks in order to obtain hundreds of thousands of dollars in personal loans, including their home mortgage. Assistant U.S. Attorney Scott Lazar says the couple also had campaign contribution checks illegally cashed for personal use at currency exchanges.
The indictment further alleges that some of the campaign workers were paid what were called consulting fees. However, some of that money, the workers were told by the Reynolds to cash those checks and to give some of the money back to the Reynolds.
Mel Reynolds is already serving a 5-year prison sentence for having sex with an underage campaign worker. For National Public Radio, I'm David Shaper in Chicago.
Russia's prime minister says Russian President Boris Yeltsin has left intensive care 3 days after undergoing heart bypass surgery. Yeltsin is relocated into the more comfortable surroundings of the Kremlin hospital, which also has an office suite for his use. Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin made the announcement during a speech today to war veterans. Yeltsin's doctors predicted yesterday Yeltsin will be handling a nearly full workload within 2 weeks. This is NPR.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. As David Brinkley has pointed out, he started doing TV news before anyone was watching. And when he stopped anchoring in 1979, he said that he'd done the news longer than anyone else on Earth. Brinkley started his broadcasting career at NBC in 1943. It was the Huntley Brinkley Report that made him one of TV's first celebrated anchors. After Chet Huntley retired, Brinkley co-anchored the NBC News with John Chancellor and became a commentator. In 1981, he joined ABC, where he began the popular Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. This weekend, he steps down as host of the show. Late Tuesday, on his final election night as a broadcaster, apparently thinking he was off the air, Brinkley stunned viewers and his fellow colleagues by calling President Clinton a bore who hasn't a creative bone in his body, and by saying voters could expect more nonsense for the next 4 years. Brinkley has written a new book that presents more of his controversial views. It's Everyone is Entitled to My Opinion. Terry Gross spoke with David Brinkley in 1989, following the publication of his book, Washington Goes to War. Brinkley told Terry what Washington was like when he first moved there in 1943.
The war had begun, of course, but it was still essentially a country town, slow-moving. People in Washington who had big business activities went to Baltimore to borrow money, because that's where the big banks were. People read the Baltimore Sun more than they read any Washington paper, because at that time we didn't have a really good paper. There were no restaurants to speak of. There was no theater to speak of. There was not much of anything to speak of. It was a sort of a fried-in-grease town.
How big was the press corps?
Not very. Nothing like what it is today. I would say, I don't really know the answer, but I would guess a few hundred.
Oh, that's pretty small.
It's in the thousands, now.
Now, you were the White House correspondent, weren't you, for, was it NBC Radio?
NBC, well, that's radio was all it was then.
Right, okay. So, listen, I figure it must have not been considered a very important beat if such a young man or someone still really a rookie was assigned to the White House in the
early
40s.
Well, partly because I got out of the Army early, and everybody was crying for male help. Female help was not as welcome then as it is now. All kinds of changes have taken place. And the White House was not really a full-time beat. The president had press conferences twice a week, one on Tuesday morning and one on Thursday afternoon. I may have those reversed, because they were intended only for newspapers. And reporters showed up at the appointed hour, went to the press conference, and left. And there were only five or six who were there all day, and there was no reason to be there all day because not much was happening. There was no such thing as a leak at that time.
So that was the White House beat, huh? You just covered
pretty much. You showed up twice a week for the press conference and left.
You point out that radio became a medium that was taken seriously as a news medium during World War II. Did you take radio very seriously when you were working in it? Did you think of it as the place you wanted to continue to work? And again, this was before television.
I did take it very seriously. I thought it was terribly important during the war more than ever before. People stayed glued to the radios because we had tremendous amounts of news. And I remember putting on all kinds of things during the war that the newspapers would not have until the next morning. And there were people all over the country who kept the radio on all day long and had a map. and they put pins in the map to keep track of activity on the war fronts as the radio reported them. And we had some very, very good reporters in those days reporting the war from the war fronts. I never did that. And so radio became a very serious and highly respected news medium.
Now, I learned from your new book that NBC used to insist that after 6 in the evening, men had to wear formal attire and black tie. How long did that regulation last, and what was the rationale for it?
Well, the rationale was that NBC wanted to be considered what it was for a long time, the foremost radio network. It was a serious enterprise. Everything on the air was live, everything. There was not even a recorded commercial. Everything was live. And they wanted to maintain a high degree of dignity and seriousness and public acceptance, and so in the photographs of radio performers at night, Fred Allen, big names in those years, all wore black tie. The announcers wore black tie. Everyone wore black tie.
Of course, no one listening to the radio could see them.
I know that.
But, I figured you'd know that, yeah.
had an effect on the... They thought it had an effect on the performance of their people.
Did you buy that yourself?
Well, I don't know. I didn't own the network, and if that's what they wanted, it was okay with me. It didn't matter.
Did you have to keep a change of clothes with you, so if you had a report after 6, you'd have your formal attire?
Yes. Yes. They stopped that eventually. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped it, but they did stop it. I think when television came along, they dropped it.
Now, was that sense of formality carried over into The Voice as well? Were you expected to sound very formal, especially in the evening hours?
Well, people in radio at that time took their diction and their speech patterns very, very seriously. I remember announcers saying in tones of awe that, what's his name, who used to announce a Metropolitan Radio, a Metropolitan Opera broadcast, Milton Cross? Was he Milton
yeah,
Cross?
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Milton Cross. They spoke of him as if he were some kind of deity because he had won a prize for having the finest diction in radio. It was good.
Now, you really have perhaps the most consciously or unconsciously imitated voice in broadcasting. How was your voice regarded when you first started working in radio? Were you considered to have a good radio voice?
I don't know that anybody paid any attention. I never heard anything about it or never thought anything about it. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Mm-hmm. I know that there were many preachers in your family, and I was wondering if they're... style of oratory affected you at all?
Because I never went to hear them.
Oh, really?
No, they were, this is before my time. There was a line of Presbyterian preachers in my background. But by the time I was old enough to go to church, and I can't say that I went, even though I was old enough very often, they were all gone.
When did you first become aware that other people in broadcasting were picking up your inflections?
I guess the first time was when somebody ran an ad in Variety, the little show business newspaper, weekly newspaper, ran an ad in Variety offering $1,500 for somebody who could record a commercial for 1 minute using my speech pattern. And the joke at the time was that I applied for it and was turned down, which is, of course, not true, but that was the joke.
Well, while we're talking about your voice, let's talk a little bit about writing. You've been praised so much for knowing how to write a simple declarative sentence and for writing really clear, concise copy for television. How did you develop your style of writing for radio and TV?
Well, I worked for United Press, which at that time had what it called a radio wire. I guess it still has it. It goes only to radio stations, and they thought I could write well, so they put me to work writing for the radio wire. And it attracted some attention because it was pretty good, I guess. And NBC hired me as a writer to write news scripts for announcers to read, which is how the news was done then. And one reason I learned to write clearly and simply was that I had to write in such a way that the announcers, who knew nothing of what they were reading, that the announcers could not read it wrongly. And... So they would emphasize the right word and not change the meaning of the sentence by emphasizing a wrong word.
Would you ever let anyone write for you? Did anyone ever write for you in your years of anchoring?
No.
Did you ever try it and have a bad experience?
No. Well, a time or two, for whatever reason, I had to read something because something happened while I was on the air. I had to read copy written by someone else, and I found I simply could not do it. I can't do it.
Why not?
I don't know. I just can't. I'm used to reading my own, saying my own words, and I cannot say somebody else's.
Now, something else that you did as a writer and as an anchor was to allow an element of irony and detachment. Were you ever criticized for that early on before it became recognized as your style?
I think I probably was, yes.
Do you remember exactly for what reasons?
For that reason, that I was ironic and sounded detached. And some critics wrote that, and if I were asked how I reacted, the answer is I didn't.
What about executives? Did they criticize you?
Well, the executives, generally speaking, didn't know a cliche from third base. They wouldn't have known it anyway. The executives in radio, when I was in radio, really didn't know much about it, much about news. What they knew about was soap operas and Fred Allen and Edgar Charlie McCarthy and so on. They didn't know anything about news.
What about in television, though, when you were ironic and somewhat detached in your readings?
Well, by that time, I think we'd all grown up, and they knew who I was and what I was, and I knew I wasn't going to change and couldn't if I wanted to, so no one ever complained about it. The only complaints I've ever heard have been from critics in print, mm-hmm. newspapers and so on. Mm-hmm. And very little of it, but it has been there.
David Brinkley talking with Terry Gross. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's 1989 interview with David Brinkley.
You've said that you learned to do TV before anyone was watching, and I guess that's pretty true. And by 1950, you were doing regular reports on the Camel News Caravan?
John Cameron Swayze and the Camel News Caravan. It was perfectly awful, Terry.
Why was it awful?
Well, partly because when one set out to do a television news program at that time, there was no history to go by. No one knew how to do it. It had never been done before. And you are not old enough to remember, but in the past, there were, in the movie theaters, newsreels between the features. And they were perfectly awful. They were owned by the movie studios, and mainly they used them to clear out the theater between features so people wouldn't sit through them twice. And there were dull, boring, silly stories about ship launchings, horse races, fashion shows, and so on. So when television came along and decided to do news, they didn't know what to do except to copy the newsreels, which is what they did. And the Swayze program, which I did do a little bit of, was, as I say, perfectly awful. It was ship launchings and fashion shows and other kinds of junk. No news, really. Not much.
Well, this was before there were rules about what made good television, and I would think that would leave you free to take certain risks and experiment a little.
Free to, but not really able to, because the facilities were so bad. The film was black and white. The sound was optical sound, very poor. It took forever to get film processed, and forever beyond that to get it edited. When it came from out of the city, New York or Washington, it had to be flown in and very often got lost at the airport. It was really a mess. So all we did was struggle and try to get something on the air, and that's about all we accomplished.
Well, in 1956, you became the co-anchor of the NBC News with Chet Huntley, mm-hmm. the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was anchoring at that time considered a real high-prestige position in the way that it's subsequently been seen?
Nothing like it has come to be since then. It was then thought of as a kind of interesting job. There weren't any real anchors before that. There was John Cameron Swayze, and on CBS along later came Doug Edwards. And on ABC, I don't think they were in the game yet. So there wasn't much. Anchoring didn't amount to much. There wasn't much to anchor. The programs are 15 minutes long. The pictures are bad. The sound is bad. Very few people had television sets, and so it didn't really amount to much. It later came to be what it is. Whatever that is, I'm not sure I know.
Do you mind me asking a question I know you've been asked a million times? But
is.
About how you were paired with Chet Huntley.
NBC thought at that time, the big name, biggest name in news at that time prior to that was Ed Murrow. And every network felt it had to have an Ed Murrow or somebody who sounded like him. NBC hired Chet Huntley, thinking he sounded like Ed Murrow. And he was in New York, and I was in Washington. For the first time, they'd resolved to cover a political convention thoroughly, because finally we had some cameras and so on, were able to do it. And they were unwilling to trust either of us alone, and so they put the two of us together, thinking that if one of us screwed up, the other could save him. There have been many arguments about who was responsible for that decision, but somebody in New York made it, and we did do the 1956 convention together. And it worked very well, and it led to the Huntley-Brinkley news report in fall of 56.
Now, I understand that you really didn't like the famous sign-off that you used every night.
I didn't.
Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Why not? It doesn't seem very offensive.
Well, it seemed silly to me. It seemed that when we said good night, we should say good night to the audience. We are there to tell them the news, not to tell each other. We're there. And I didn't think it sounded too good, two men saying good night to each other on the air. We should say good night to the audience. And I fought and argued and fought and argued and lost. The producer insisted that we say good night, Chet, and good night, David. So finally we gave in, and we did, and it became, for a long time, part of the language.
Since it caught on, do you think that you were wrong, or do you think that you were right?
Well, I don't know. Who's to say? But yeah. It caught on, and so I couldn't argue anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were first paired to cover a convention together, and you've said that you have always really liked covering conventions. You've thought of them as kind of big parties, big games, a lot of excitement. I was wondering what you felt at the Chicago convention. In the Democratic Convention in 1968.
68?
Yeah.
I felt I was in a foreign country. I was shocked by what was happening out there in the streets. Students being beaten by the police. The mayor of Chicago turning out the sewer workers to fill up the auditorium to cheer him and to hold up signs saying, "We love Mayor Daley." It truly was shocking and somewhat frightening. I remember that was at about the time when the Russians had gone into Czechoslovakia to shut down the democratic movement there under Dubček. And I remember saying on the air, "Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?" Well, the mayor, needless to say, didn't like that, but it was true. I was shocked by it and infuriated by it.
Now, did you get any flack for saying that? Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?
I got some flack from Mayor Daley, but not much from anybody else. I think everybody else outside of Chicago was shocked at what happened there.
Mm-hmm. David Brinkley is my guest. You know, on your Sunday morning show this week with David Brinkley, one of the weekly participants and commentators is Sam Donaldson. And I wonder if you think things have changed in terms of where the line is drawn for a reporter or an anchor being allowed to express opinions on the air.
It's a good question, and it's a question that none of us has ever really been able to figure out in a satisfactory way. Obviously, when Sam is on the air with me and George and whoever else on Sunday mornings, he is not giving the news. We are having a discussion. We're not saying what happened. We're saying what we think about what happened, and it is clearly labeled. No one is deceived by it. Nevertheless, there are people who think reporters, people who report news in an objective, though I don't like that word, fashion, should not sometime later on the same station, same channel, be giving his opinions. And as I say, I can't really satisfy myself on that point. I still have questions about it.
Where do you think of yourself as falling in the political spectrum?
I have spent my entire working life avoiding any political label.
Mm-hmm.
The only answer I can give you is that depending on what it is, I am either a liberal or a conservative. That's no answer, I know, but I can't give you an answer. It depends on what the question is.
Mm-hmm. When people come on your show on Sunday morning, I'm sure they come on determined to just say what it is that they've decided to say beforehand. And then it's your job and the jobs of the other people on the show to try to get them to go beyond what they've prepared in advance. Is that very difficult to do? And do you think of yourself or as the other people on the program as having certain techniques of pushing people further than they planned to go?
Yes. Everything you say is true. Everyone we have on the air, usually it's some sort of political figure or an academic figure or some sort of intellectual figure. Every one of them will arrive in a studio with some little sermonette in mind and determined to deliver it. So one thing I do is first ask them a dull, boring question like, what do you think about this? And let them deliver their little sermonette. And then we get to the hardcore of what we're there to talk about. Let them get it out of their system before they will go into anything else.
That sermonette can be kind of long. How do you make sure it's concise sermonette?
Interrupt. Uh-huh. I don't let them run on all night.
Uh-huh.
They do that before they come, and if they try to go into a filibuster, I had one not long ago, one from the SNL industry who wanted to filibuster, and I stopped him. I cut him off. I do it politely, but we do it.
You started on television before there was videotape, so you couldn't watch a tape-delayed broadcast of your show. You couldn't watch the videotape and see how you were doing. Do you remember the first time you actually watched yourself on videotape, what the experience was like?
I remember I didn't like it. And I didn't like how I looked and sounded, didn't like anything about it, and I've almost never looked at myself since. I'm serious. I mean that. Our Sunday program at 10:30 is done live. At 11:30, we play back the tape to the West Coast and so on. I could easily sit and watch it all. I never, ever watch it.
And why not?
I don't want to look at myself. I don't know why not. Maybe I'm crazy.
But do you ever think, well, you should overcome that feeling so you could see the show and critique it and see if there's anything you wanted to change? Or...
Well, since I was on it, I know what is on the program,
right.
And I know
okay.
what I think was pretty good and what I think was less than good, and so I don't really need to do that to critique it. But as for looking at myself, it really doesn't appeal to me, mm-hmm. and I don't do it. I truly almost never have done it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the news and about your broadcasting career. Thank you very much for your time.
Terry, thank you. I've enjoyed being with you.
David Brinkley steps down this Sunday as host of This Week with David Brinkley. His new book is Everyone's Entitled to My Opinion. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook Baking with Julia, Savor the Joys of Baking with America's Best Bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Irish writer William Trevor. Some of his recent New Yorker stories have been collected in a new book. We'll listen to a 1995 interview with him. Maureen Corrigan wonders about a new bestseller for women who want to capture Mr. Right. And John Powers reviews Set It Off, the new film co-starring rapper Queen Latifah.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's possible there are some people who haven't yet heard of the rules, but their numbers are fast dwindling. Over the past few months, the slim book, which contains 35 do's and don'ts for women looking for a man, has been hotly debated on Oprah and discussed in the New York Times. Also sweeping the country are rules seminars and support groups. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says the rules offers a constricting guide to how men and women should relate to each other that even centuries-old plays and novels about romance don't endorse.
The view that romance is a sweetly random thing, a matter of Cupid and arrows, isn't much comfort to those single women who've spent years prowling bars and bookstores trying to entice eligible men. It's many of these women, itching to control their own amorous destinies, who've made The Rules a mega bestseller. By the thousands, they've fallen for the retro message of The Rules. That is, in order to snag Prince Charming, a gal must exhaustively discipline herself into passivity. The Rules was written by two women, Ellen Fine and Sherry Schneider, whose big claim to expertise is that they're both married. What can you expect when you do The Rules? Coyly ask the authors. The answer is total adoration from the man of your dreams. Naturally, in the rules scheme of things, feminists are predestined for spinsterhood. Some women, sniff the rules authors, feel their diplomas and paychecks entitle them to do more than wait for the phone to ring. These women, we assure you, always end up heartbroken. The Rules is subtitled Time-Tested Secrets for Capturing the Heart of Mr. Right. So I decided to look at some time-tested tales of love to see if their heroines adhered to the rules or beneficially broke them. Let's start with the advice in rule number 3. Don't be funny if he's serious. Just go with the flow. Oh, how fortunate Elizabeth Bennet was to have been born into fiction 2 centuries before the rules could have ruined her happiness. Jane Austen writes of Elizabeth that she had a lively, playful disposition which delighted in anything ridiculous. And we all know where that undampened comic disposition got her with the doer Mr. Darcy. By novel's end, she's become mistress of his heart and his lavish ancestral estate. On the other hand, Anna Karenina tried hard to follow the advice about conversing with men contained within Rule 9. Be sweet and light, laugh at his jokes. Yet Tolstoy describes one such conversation between Anna and her husband as less than successful. Anna's remarks were all said lightly, rapidly, and with a peculiar brilliance in her eyes. But her husband did not now attach any significance to this tone of hers. On to Rule 16. Don't tell him what to do. Chaucer's lusty wife of Bath would heartily disagree. In her native Middle English, the wife boasts of her treatment of her 5 husbands. I governed them so well after my law that each of them full blissful was and faw to bring me gay things from the fair. That brings us to Rule 23. Don't date a married man. I guess Jane Eyre shouldn't have dallied with Mr. Rochester while his mad wife Bertha was still rattling around in the attic. But then again, Charlotte Bronte's novel draws to a close with words the rules authors would approve of. Reader, I married him. Granted, not all classic romances end so jubilantly. Shakespeare's Juliet might have sealed her doom by breaking Rule 15, don't rush into sex. But maybe her fatal mistake was really trying to follow Rule 24, slowly involve him in your family. The literary characters who act most like consummate rules girls are Scarlett O'Hara and that man-trap, Estella, from Dickens' Great Expectations, and neither of them wind up happy. So it's your call. Either follow the rules in a calculated campaign to achieve romantic bliss, or take your direction from the great writers of the Western world who seem to agree that, in love as in other aspects of life, much madness is divinest sense.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University.
Thank you.
Coming up, writer William Trevor. This is Fresh Air. The Irish writer William Trevor isn't famous in America, but he does have many readers here, and they tend to regard him with near reverence. Stephen Schiff profiled Trevor in The New Yorker a couple of years ago. Schiff wrote, "Trevor is probably the greatest living writer of short stories in the English language." He described Trevor as a mild man, retiring and soft-spoken, famously shy. And he also observed that almost nothing about Trevor suggests that he could possibly know anything of the throttled romances, blistering humiliations, and free falls into madness that rack his characters' lives. William Trevor has a new collection of short stories called After Rain. Trevor grew up in the south of Ireland, where much of his fiction is set. He moved to England as a young man, where he's lived ever since. When he spoke with Terry Gross in 1995, he told her that as a child, his family never stayed in one place for very long.
We moved around simply because my father was a bank official, and every time he got promotion, the practice was to move the man who got promotion from one town to another in order to put him up a step. I don't know why that was the practice, but it was, so that we lived in seven or eight small Irish towns during my childhood, because he was actually quite a clever and able bank official, and he was rising slowly to the top of his profession, and we all went with him, of course.
Was there anything all the different towns you lived in had in common?
The different towns?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were all very similar. I think having in common is an understatement. They're almost interchangeable, some of them. They're very, very similar places. As my father advanced, they got slightly bigger and more important because he was obviously being given a more important job. But it does mean that I have got no hometown, which I rather regret. They're all my hometown, and I even towns in Ireland where I haven't lived, I feel belongs to me somehow or other, because I feel so very, very strongly a provincial, small-town person.
What do you think a hometown would give you that you don't have?
Well, a hometown, I suppose, would give you a kind of coziness, which I don't have. But I'm rather glad, from a writer's point of view, I was speaking personally just then, from a writer's point of view, one shouldn't really have that cozy feeling. A writer is, at least this writer is, an outsider. And I feel outside society, and that coziness of belonging is something I would be very, very suspicious of and wary about, and really wouldn't want to have in the end. It's fiction writers are much spikier people than that. They're beady-eyed and watchful, and you can't do that from inside. You've got to do it from outside the pale, and I feel that I belong outside the pale. That maybe is why I don't live in Ireland.
In a recent memoir, you wrote a little bit about your parents and their unhappy marriage. You described them as victims of their innocence. I wanted to know if you could elaborate on what you meant by that.
Well, I think that my parents, when I said victims of their innocence, all I meant really was that my parents didn't know an awful lot. They were simple people. They didn't know an awful lot, first of all, about each other before they married each other. They didn't know an awful lot about marriage. And I suspect they didn't know an awful lot about love. But they married, and they seemed a very attractive young couple. My father was a handsome man. My mother was very beautiful. But they were the last two people on this earth who should have married. And we three children grew up with that like a cloud hanging over us almost every day of our childhood, which was a fairly gloomy household at times.
What made them so wrong for each other?
Well, I think that one of the things that made them so wrong for each other. And in a strange sense was that they were both very humorous people. My mother had a good sense of humor, and so had my father. But their senses of humor didn't meet. They laughed at different things. The world seemed to both of them a rather different place, and what was amusing in the world to my mother was not amusing to my father, and vice versa. Now, that may seem a very small thing, but I believe that that's an enormously important thing in marriage and relationships, that if you laugh and are amused at and find interesting the same things, you get on. If you don't, somehow or other there is a blankness on the other face when you make a joke or tell a story. And I was always aware of this with my parents, and that was one of the areas of life which I think was very difficult. There were other reasons why they didn't get on. My father was a jollier person, in a sense, than my mother was. He was a more social person, more gregarious person. And also there was the very difficult problem of moving from the towns we've been talking about, from one town to another, which was hard on my mother, but rather nice for my father, because he was advancing in his career, he was doing well, he was making more money, he was able to exert more influence locally and all that kind of thing, whereas my mother was presented with some really rather nasty house which she had to have repapered and repainted. And each time that happened, there would be maybe 6 months of upheaval. And this is not easy for a woman.
After college, you moved to England. Did your Irish background feel different to you in England than it had in Ireland?
Oh, yes. I didn't want to leave Ireland. The one thing I didn't want to do at that time, this is about 1952, the one thing I really knew is that I did not want ever to leave Ireland. I wanted to be in Ireland all my life, and I hated the idea of exile, but it was necessary and I had to do it. Now, of course, I see that I probably would have never written anything if I had stayed in Skibbereen all my life, or Mitchelstown, where I was born. You have to travel in order to see Ireland in perspective.
I think for about 15 years you worked as a sculptor before you started to write at all. Did you realize you had a gift for writing before you actually started to write?
Well, I was good at English. I was one of those boys, one of those children who was, you know, good at English at school, not good at anything else very much, but I did happen to be good at English. But then I became very interested in sculpture, not painting, but I became interested in sculpture because it just so happened that the art master was a sculptor. And I was a sculptor for a long time. I didn't make very much money. I seemed always to fail to make money when I was young. And I had to, in the end, give that up and get a job writing advertising copy, which I did for a couple of years.
Could you remember for us any of the ads that you wrote?
I can't remember any slogans or headlines. Is a question I'm always asked, and I'm always glad to say I've forgotten them all, because they were no good. I was very bad at it.
Gee, so did that hurt any confidence you thought you might have as a writer?
Oh, no, not at all. No, it's a different, it really is a different thing altogether. The good thing about writing advertisements was that when I went to that job, I wasn't given very much work at first, naturally enough, because I was a novice. And I had a great deal of time on my hands, and I was given a typewriter and endless cups of tea. And, you know, in those days, they would say, write an advertisement for a brand of paint or something, but you take your time over it. You know, you take 2 days to write that advertisement. I say, what do you mean? 12 lines, 2 days? And they say, yes, because it's got to be good, you know, and it's got to be absolutely right. Well, of course, I would write what I could in a couple of minutes and then put it aside. And then I began to write short stories because I had nothing else to do. And that's how, really, I began to write.
So what were the subjects of the first stories that you wrote?
The subjects of the first stories were, there were stories, I think that the only thing they perhaps had in common is quite a number of them were about elderly people, and I can't really tell you why that was. I wrote a novel called The Old Boys, which is entirely about elderly men and one woman. And I wrote a number of short stories about people who were in their 70s. And I think that the reason I did that was that I was curious to know what it was like to be very old. I was myself in my early 30s. Now that I'm closer to 70 than 30, I write more about children, because, of course, I have forgotten in all sorts of ways what it's like to be a child. But when I stopped writing about the elderly, I wrote a great deal and have since written an awful lot about women, because I am not a woman and I want to know more about women. I write all the time out of a sense of curiosity. That's what drives me, as far as I can see, to write.
Well, you're how old now?
66.
66. So you're still not at the age that you were describing, but you're closer to it than you were in your 30s. Do you think you came close in your descriptions from what you can tell now?
Not bad. Not too bad. All sorts of things I didn't know about, which certainly not in those early stories. Perhaps not enough emphasis on the loss of memory, which all old people have. But they're not bad.
You know, even in your memoir, a lot of the memoir is actually about other people you've known or about places that you've been. Your memoir is filled with portraits of others. I get the impression you really don't like to write about yourself very much, that there's two things working here. One is your curiosity of others, and another is a reluctance to explore yourself in a public way.
Yes, I have very little interest in myself. I'm sitting here talking to you, whom I can't see, and I am more interested in you than I am in what I am saying to you. I am one of those people who, for some reason, is interested in other people more than in himself, and I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's part of being a writer or whether it's just part of being a human being. I have absolutely no idea, but it's there, and I don't reject it. I use it. I use everything in order to write something.
See, that's interesting to me, because I think so many writers are very obsessive people, and usually one of the things they're obsessed with is themselves.
I'm sure that's true, but I'm not obsessed with myself. I'm obsessed with my friends. I mean, I'm very fond of my friends, and I'm very fond of my family, and they seem to come first, and I trail along someplace behind. I don't know. On the other hand, of course, talking like this, one has to say that all fiction is autobiographical in a sense, because it's autobiographical in the sense that I can only write about the physical pain that I feel. I can't write about the physical pain that you feel, because I don't quite know what it is like for you. It's like saying, when I see the color blue, I see the color blue. You may see a slightly different color. So I have to use as a yardstick my own feelings for pain, distress, happiness, everything else. Those are all things which I've experienced, and that experience goes into the characters I write about. So that there's always that autobiographical strand in everything. But it's almost a technical thing. It's almost using myself as a piece of litmus paper.
Do you think of yourself as an interesting person?
Well, not particularly. I would much prefer to hope that people found what I wrote interesting than that they should find I am interesting. I think that what people get when they meet a fiction writer is the remains of someone, because the bulk of everything in that person has gone into what he has written, or in the case of a painter, gone into what he's painted.
What are you working on now?
Well, I always work in the same way. I work on short stories and usually a novel at the same time, so that when the novel gets into difficulties, or when I become tired of this particular part of it, or, you know, whatever reason, I can just drop it and begin a new short story. And it's a luxury for a fiction writer to be a short story writer and also to be a novelist. I think of myself as a short story writer in the first place. But to be a novelist as well is a luxury, because I can turn to another craft, because they're quite different. The two crafts are quite different.
How are they different?
Well, you can, with a short story, you can see around it. It's like when having something in your mind that you can sort of see almost in the round, you can sort of see to the end of it, although in fact you may change the end may be quite different and you may begin it at a different place, but you can see much more of it when you begin it, before you begin it, and while you're writing it. With a novel, you can't do that at all, at least I can't. I mean, everything I say is personal. It's purely the way I write. Other people would be quite different. But with a novel, I find that to be able to see round a novel and to be able to see a complete novel or anything even vaguely like a complete novel would be like carrying the architectural plans for a cathedral in your mind, which you can't do. A novel evolves much, much more than a short story. A short story does evolve, but simply because of the length. It's a different thing. It's a different product. It's a different commodity. A short story is a glimpse. Essentially, it's the art of the glimpse. The novel is more of a mixture, more of a, I suppose you could almost say, a rag bag.
Well, William Trevor, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
William Trevor's new collection of short stories is After Rain. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1995. This is Fresh Air. Last year, the movie Waiting to Exhale tapped into an underserved audience and became a surprise hit. Set It Off is a new picture also about a group of African-American women, but it explores completely different territory. Will it also succeed? Our film critic John Powers hopes so.
Ever since Thelma and Louise feminized the road movie and became a sensation in the process, Hollywood has been putting women in parts once reserved for men. Usually the results are nothing special. The Long Kiss Goodnight is just another action movie, despite the presence of Gina Davis firing the Uzis. But sometimes putting new kinds of characters into old-fashioned roles creates an illuminating spark. That's precisely what happens in Set It Off, a terrific new crime picture that puts a 90s spin on a 50s-style heist film. Set It Off tells the story of four African-American women from South Central L.A. who work for a janitorial service cleaning high-rises. They decide to rob a bank, each for a different reason. Tashawn is a single mother who needs money so her child won't be taken away by the state. Frankie's recently been fired as a bank teller because she froze during a holdup. Stoney, who's played by beautiful Jada Pinkett, has just seen her brother mistakenly gunned down by the cops. And then there's Cleo, a rough-and-tumble lesbian played by Queen Latifah. Cleo doesn't have a complicated motive for wanting to rob banks. It's enough that she wants the money. Of course, committing armed robbery is serious stuff, and before these friends get down to the business of crime, they have to work through their fears and reservations.
Y'all gonna have to do this without me. I keep thinking about Darnell getting killed and Lorenz shot. Stevie.
That's because Darnell and them were a bunch of damn fools. They don't know half of what I know about banks.
What if something goes wrong? What if somebody gets hurt?
Listen to me. Damn, you're just scared, baby. Ain't nobody gonna get hurt. That's why this is the perfect crime. I know this too well.
What about all them folks' money you taking?
Insurance. Dumbass comment.
Look, we just taken away from the system. Let's do it.
Set It Off is directed by F. Gary Gray, whose first film, Friday, was an amusingly sloppy little picture that cost $3 million and grossed 10 times that much. While this new film is more professional-looking, I kept wishing that Gray were better at streamlining his material. This taut, gritty tale should run no more than 90 minutes, But the movie takes 2 full hours because of a gratuitous sex scene, a bevy of MTV flourishes, and a protracted subplot about Stoney's relationship with a buppy banker, played by the almost comically handsome Blair Underwood from L.A. Law. Yet despite feeling padded, the movie pulls you along from beginning to end. Gray has a nice feel for the friendship of these women. Some of the best scenes come when the four just sit around talking. And the story's anchored by 2 first-rate performances. Queen Latifah is shockingly confident as the reckless Cleo, who's like the female equivalent of hot-tempered Sonny Corleone in The Godfather or Johnny Boy in Mean Streets. Feisty and exuberant, she'd sooner burn down the whole world than give an inch. Jada Pinkett Stoney is almost the opposite. Quiet, thoughtful, and possessed with gravitas, she's the film's moral center, the one who watches in horror as things go fatally wrong. Set It Off moves from giddiness to tragedy. And even though its plot is formulaic, its closing scenes are weighty. We care about what happens to these women. They aren't the wisecracking crooks you find in those post-Tarantino crime pictures, guys who kill and rob because it's somehow cool. Nor are they the saucy chicks from Waiting to Exhale who spend all their time griping about men. No, Stoney, Cleo, Tishon, and Frankie are driven by a desire for freedom. They want to escape the projects and stop being second-class citizens, even if it gets them killed. All of which makes Set It Off something rare and compelling, a Hollywood crime picture that cares less about being hip than having a social conscience.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publishers of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia, Savor the Joys of Baking with America's Best Bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.